to me.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. I'm on the road filming three separate important feature documentaries on socially relevant issues in the heartland, filming on farms, regular farms, farms that produce genetically engineered material and organic. All that will be revealed come the fall, but there are some films that are in post-production come June. I was thinking early this morning about who's not being served, and a lot of people are not being served by any of the commentaries in our society today, and as a result, there's simply no way that we can help them. One of the issues I would like to address, and I'd like your input, are all of our soldiers who are committing suicide each year. Now, we know about the 4,486 Americans who've been killed in Iraq since 2003, and we know about the 1,936 American soldiers who have been killed in Afghanistan since 2001. But according to the American Journal of Public Health, when you look at how many of our soldiers are committing suicide, it's just staggering. For example, last year, 6,500 veterans committed suicide. But that's every year. That's an average. Well, that's more that commit suicide in 1 year than were killed in Afghanistan and Iraq combined in their entirety. So we have tens of thousands who are dying of their own hand, and we're not asking why. We're not asking what meds they're on. We're not asking about how many times we put them back into the theater of operation. I'll deal with that today in a commentary from Mark Ames from Consortium News. It's entitled Murder, Suicide, and Financial Ruin, How the Class War is Destroying American Lives. It's very interesting. Also, my guest from yesterday, Martha Rosenberg, has been invited back for a full hour on my Aunt Monday Evening Progressive Commentary Hour, along with Dr. Bruce Ames, and they're going to take apart the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychiatry. They're also going to take apart all of psychiatry and show you what kind of fraud it is. You won't want to miss that. But today I'm going to share you a commentary by her entitled Four Creepy Ways Big Pharma Peddles Its Drugs. I think you'll find this interesting. Also, How Wealth Reduces Compassion from Daisy Gruall. From Common Dreams. Also today, five reasons why the very rich have not earned their money. From Paul Buchheit. And finally, How Psychiatry Stigmatizes Depression Sufferers by Dr. Bruce Levine. We have a lot to share. No guests today because I wanted more time for you to call in and have your input as well. But we always begin with the latest on health and healing. This deals with something rarely eaten in the United States. It's called watercress. But according to some research done at Edinburgh University in Scotland, the University of Ulster, Northern Ireland, we should be eating it regularly. Why? Because, quote, 8 weeks of supplementation with watercress can reduce markers of oxidative stress and damage after exhaustive exercise. And what they did in this study, they took a group of very healthy men, and they gave them a certain amount of watercress every day, and then they took a look at how much damage occurs to the body with and without it. The results were published in the British Journal of Nutrition, and it's very promising. When they had the watercress, it reduced oxidative stress and reduced damage, and that's a big plus. I would add to that that there's certain nutrients that allow you to exercise further and with greater resistance, such as DMG, dimethylglycine. Very important. Also important is NADH and PPQ, 10-20 milligrams PPQ. Those are also good for allowing extensive exercise. Multivitamins boosts brain function. This is according to a new research published in the British Journal of Nutrition and Psychopharmacology and Human Psychopharmacology. What this says is this, that taking a multiple vitamin supplement every day can improve cognitive performance in both the young and the old. So that's good. And of course, not all multiple supplements are the same, and try to get those that are more broad spectrum, as so you're getting a full complementation. But that's good news, and again, it's done in a good way. For those of you who are diabetic or pre-diabetic, and by the way, pre-diabetic are about 50 million. Diabetic are upwards realistically of 30 million. So we're talking about 80 million people. That's an awful lot of people in the United States. So anything that you can do to prevent this from happening, you should. Now, this study was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. What they found in this study was that they isolated some compounds in licorice root that could help with the treatment of diabetes. And these have similar chemical structures that are very important to a particular fruit. And, quote, the health beneficial effects are based upon the fact that the amifrutin molecules dock directly onto receptors in a nucleus called PPAR gamma. And the binding of these molecules activates various genes that reduce the plasma concentration of certain fatty acids and glucose. The reduced glucose levels prevents the development of insulin resistance, the main cause of adult diabetes, end quote. So in just lay language, that's the actual scientific article. This should be very important, so all pre-diabetics and diabetics, pay attention to this. Now let me spell it for you. It is A-M-O-R-P-H-A. Second word, F-R-U-T-I-C-O-S-A. It's a bush, and it's a fruit of the bush. So anyhow, that's good news for diabetics and pre-diabetics, and we haven't heard or seen that anywhere else, so I'm going to share that with you. This is from Science Daily, and this is from the American Community Survey, and here's what they came up with. More baby boomers are facing old age alone. I'll quote this. Startling new statistics from Bowling Green State University's National Center for Family and Marriage Research paint a bleak picture of the future for the largest generation in history, the baby boomers, as they cross into old age. And then they use data from the 1980s, 90s, 2000s, and 2009, and they found that the vast majority are unmarried and are going into this point of their life alone. Quote, most single boomers are divorced or never married. In fact, one in three single baby boomers has never been married. And just 10% of unmarried boomers are widowed. The shift in marital composition of the middle age suggests that researchers and policymakers can no longer focus on widowhood in later life and should pay attention to the vulnerabilities of the never married and divorced as well, end quote. Now, here's my perspective on that. I believe that they have taken an extremely narrow focus. I know it's very important to have quality relationships. But many people my age, many baby boomers, have realized that some of the greatest joy and creativity in life is shared with your friends and your extended family. And that our generation, the baby boomers, we're not playing by the normal rules. I know people that if you said, would you work a 9-to-5 job, they would say no. These people work much different hours and sometimes extreme hours, but they're creating. And creative people don't like to be interfered with. They like to live by their own notions. A lot of people don't like waking up in the morning and feeling they have to be responsible for how someone else feels about everything. This is unique, and it's even more so in younger generations, as I've just found because I've just finished a major book on that. In fact, I've sent it into the publisher now. It's 900 pages. So I believe that there's a lot of people in academia who have missed completely the idea that we no longer have to go through the transitions in life as partners or as a relationship. Many people choose to have a relationship with themselves, which is something really different and unique in a society that is valued above all the marriage and the extended family. And for those who the marriage and extended family is very important, such as the adaptive supportive life energies, which are probably about 80% of the people, that's fine. But that does not work well for the creative assertives, the dynamic supportives, and the dynamic aggressives. There's a whole lot of other people who have a different idea, and they're not lonely, and they're not depressed, and they're not feeling abandoned, and they don't fear loss. They're happy each day. And I think that we should have some emphasis placed upon what it means to be happy each day. We certainly play enough emphasis upon what it is to be depressed each day, angry each day, sick each day, overweight each day, suffering from pain and fatigue every day. That gets the interest. Where do we have a corresponding interest in joyfulness, creativity, happiness, sharing, compassion, community service? We don't. It's the exception. And I believe it's a lot more common, meaning good people doing good things, happy people, joyful in life, than what we have been led to believe. I believe there are tens of millions of Americans who have got their act together at whatever age they are and are happy with their life and happy with their freedoms. Freedoms where they don't want people transgressing their boundaries. So I would challenge this whole idea that, oh, we're facing something alone, as if just being alone is the same as loneliness or abandonment. It is not. And there needs to be the second half of this dialogue shared. Next up, chocolate gives statins a $29 billion run for their money. This is from Green Med Info, and it says, with the blockbuster cholesterol-lowering class of drugs known as statins being widely promoted for the primary prevention of cardiovascular disease, despite their having over 300 different documented adverse health effects, including heart failure, how does chocolate sound as a viable heart-friendly alternative? Now, on this program, on dozens of occasions, I've cited the peer-reviewed literature of how healthy chocolate can make a difference. And indeed, it does. Indeed, researchers far back as 2006 found that in elderly men, eating coca intake was inversely associated with blood pressure and a 15-year cardiovascular and all-cause mortality, meaning you lived a longer life. You would not die from any cause at the same level as if you were eating it. Compare with the lowest group that was taking the least. And there's no bad consideration of the coca intake. And they were only suggesting a small amount. That was 2.11 grams per day. That's a tiny amount. That's like a half an ounce. Is less than a half an ounce a week. So I'm suggesting 2 ounces a day. Quote, anything that can reduce your risk of dying from all causes by 50%, which is not an expensive and potentially dangerous drug, but a food, should be taken seriously. Even if paradoxically, it is usually found in the candy section of the grocery store. So we have the studies, all the studies that show that eating chocolate each day, healthy chocolate, will reduce both the cardiovascular disease death factors and the hard cardiovascular outcomes, such as hypertension and endothelial dysfunction and insulin resistance and low HDL and stroke and heart disease. So there are at least 30 such studies that I have just on that alone. So I'm suggesting you have your chocolate each day. You could be doing yourself an enormous amount of good. And again, the studies are there, reducing oxidative stress and stimulating, helping people with Alzheimer's, and lots of good information. Now, here's what we're going to round off this segment with, and that's the five herbs and spices that help lower blood sugar. First and foremost, understand that a lot of people have high blood sugar and don't know it. Because unless you're getting a test, you won't know. And it's like having high blood pressure and not knowing it. That's why they call it the silent killer. So here are some things you can do on a daily basis. First and foremost is cinnamon. it gets my top rating. Now, there are several ways of taking cinnamon. You can take cinnamon just as a powder and put it into a smoothie or into a hot cereal. Great, that's one way. You can get cinnamon capsules and take two or three of those right after a meal. That's good. It'll prevent your blood sugar from spiking. So I would take that. And in fact, cinnamon was found to have 18% phenol content by dry weight. Very important for preventing insulin resistance and to improve insulin sensitivity and blood glucose control. So that's good. Then second would be cloves. People generally don't have cloves, but they should. It contains 30% levels of antioxidant phenol by dry weight, and it also has anthocyanins and quercetin. It's an antiseptic, very strong germicidal properties, and it has anti-inflammatory and analgesic and digestive properties. And clove oil is what dentists have used for toothaches, but you could also use it for coughs, indigestion, and headaches. Then another superstar, but it's exaggerated what one of the people I hear on the radio say about it. He's selling it and therefore not giving us the science behind it. And I've seen all the science behind it. Very important, but not a miracle, is oregano. Now, it's generally found in Spain and the Mediterranean. It's used in cooking all the time. It's known as marjoram, M-A-R-J-O-R-A-M. It adds depth and flavor to any dish, and you'll generally find it in eggplant and tomato dishes. And it's great for killing bacteria and parasites. I mean, it really does a super good job, but also if you know anyone who has head lice, it will help kill all the head lice. I've seen it treat giardia, an infection of the intestines brought on by microscopic parasites, and E. coli. So it's really good. Then there's sage. Sage contains phytosterols, and those are known for cooling the system. And they're very important for women to treat uterine bleeding and cramps. In fact, there's a German study of sage that shows that diabetics who drank infusions of sage on an empty stomach reduced their blood sugar levels. So that's good. And finally, I would round it off with garlic. Because garlic contains sulfur compounds, specifically hydrogen sulfide gas, which dilate your blood vessels and allow blood flow to increase, and that reduces blood pressure. And it also helps in the metabolism of iron and protects you against oxidative damage and even lowers your cholesterol. It's just one of the all-time best flavoring agents there is, fresh garlic, but you've got to saute it by itself, very low flame, until it's just starting to get golden, but never brown, never black. And then it's got a sweet flavor. And you have to thinly slice it, not big chunks. And then put it into brown rice, or in beans, or a soup, or stuff it into a baked potato. So it's just great. When I'm able to find a restaurant in my travels, and I'll ask them what they have, and they almost always have broccoli. And I'll ask them, I say, well, I want a whole bowl of garlic with some broccoli in it. And they look at me and say, what do you mean? I said, well, I'll pay for a bowl of garlic. A bowl? Yeah, a bowl. I eat a bowl of garlic. That's a lot of garlic. And I don't suggest you do that. You do that, I'll tell you, you'll be up all night. So don't do it. But garlic is just one of the most perfect things in the world. A, it will kill parasites and bacteria in your throat, in the intestine. It can kill Helicobacter E. pylori in the stomach. It's great for detoxification, cleansing, blood purification. Terrific. Stimulates toxins out of the liver. So that's all good. So those are five things that you can do each day. Not difficult, not expensive. All of those are inexpensive to get yourself healthier. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. of you, all over the world, all of the land-based stations that are carrying us, thank you very much for being there. The takeaway message today is cooperation. I'm seeing with all of the different groups out there, start at the beginning. Begin with a grassroots effort. Stay away from the big environmental groups. They've all been compromised. But it's the grassroots are really getting the people out, joining together, and then join others and say, look, I'll help you with your anti-worm effort if you help me with my anti-hydrofracking, and then get other people to work. And you work together towards one common cause at a time. Historically, everyone's done their own thing. So you have a lot of very committed, very earnest, very well-meaning people, but getting nothing accomplished because they're not working cooperatively. Cooperation, that's the key. And I'm seeing more and more of that now. I'm going to share four commentaries. Then I'm going to ask you to call in and share your points of view on any of the things I'm just talking about. These are relatively short. The first comes to us from Paul Buchheit from Common Dreams. And it's five reasons why the very rich have not earned their money. One, they've taken all the middle class wage increases. In the 1980s, the richest 1% of Americans took one of every 15 post-tax dollars. Now, according to the IRS figures, they take three of every 15 post-tax income dollars. They've tripled their cut of America's income pie. That's $1 trillion extra a year that goes in their pocket. And for every dollar the richest 1% earned in 1980, they've added three more dollars. The poorest 90% have added one cent. Yet the average American factory worker, according to Berkeley economist Enrico Moretti, produces $180,000 worth of goods a year, more than three times what they produced in 1978. So workers have tripled their productivity over 30 years, while the richest 1% have tripled their share of income. Worker pay remained flat, as the top 10% took almost all the productivity gains since 1980. Number two, they've mismanaged key American industries. We have the most expensive healthcare system in the world. Failing banks have survived because of taxpayer bailouts. Management-approved shortcuts have led to workplace deaths and chemical leak disasters. Company lobby for cap-and-trade laws so that their profits can pay for their pollution. Over 20% of Americans are unemployed or underemployed as big companies hoard $2 trillion in cash. 93% of post-recession income is going to 1% job creators with no appreciable increase in jobs. Private tuition is skyrocketing, with student loans over $1 trillion. Bonuses continue for executives at Ford and Bank of America and Sirius and other companies who have underperformed or laid off workers. No, the captains of industry have not earned their money because of their top-notch management skills. Number three, they benefited from 50 years of public research. The very rich have made their fortunes in good part because of taxpayer-funded research at the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which created the Internet, the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation, and numerous other government agencies. Consider just a simple communications device. Computer chips and audio-video voice technologies grew out of decades of funding at the Department of Defense, the Air Force, NASA, and public universities. The pieces of the device were put together by a procession of chemists, physicists, chip designers, programmers, engineers, production line workers, market analysts, testers, troubleshooters, etc. They, in turn, couldn't have succeeded without another layer of people providing substance and medical support and security and administrative assistance, transportation and office maintenance and all technologies. All of them contributed to the final product. Good. That's true. But over the years, private businesses have received government contracts to produce and market the results. The entrepreneurs have rearranged the pieces into products that seem to appear out of the magical world of a single individual. Well, they didn't do any of that. It was done for them. We paid for it, yet they benefit for it. Just as an aside, how many times have governmental agencies paid for medical research and then allowed a private pharmaceutical company to be given, without any fee, a patented medicine that they then profit from all the time. Number four, they've increased their incomes, but not because they pay taxes. The richest 10% own 80% of the stock market, providing billions in unearned income that is taxed at less than half the rate of income earned through real work. Hedge fund managers call their income carried interest instead of income to keep their tax rate at 15%. Even this small amount may not be paid. Hedge fund managers with incomes in the billions can pay zero income tax by deferring their profits through their companies indefinitely. Real tax rates for the richest Americans have gone way down over the last 30 years. 34% in 1980, 23% in 2006, yet the 1% claim they pay most of the taxes. They don't. If all taxes are considered, based upon recent data from the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, the total of all state and local taxes, Social Security taxes, and excise taxes, meaning on gasoline, consumes 22% of the annual incomes of the poorest Americans. For the top 1% of Americans, the same taxes consume less than 10% of their incomes. In addition, most inherited wealth goes untaxed, with estates valued at up to $5 million exempt from federal taxes. The average tax rate on inheritance is less than 3%. And then number five, they've contributed little to society. The richest individuals and corporations have shown little regard for the majority of Americans who depend upon sound financial management for their economic security. According to sources such as the New York Times and ProPublica, Wall Street firms including J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, and Bank of America, and Goldman Sachs have been repeatedly charged with fraud only to avoid punishment by paying a fraction of their profits and fines. Financial insiders have figured out how to cheat other investors by timing the purchase of a stock option to precede good corporate news, timing the sale of a stock option to precede bad corporate news, and changing the purchase date on a stock option to a time when the price was lower. One hedge fund manager, John Paulson, made $4 billion by working with Goldman Sachs to create a financial product that would allow him to bet on the collapse of the housing market. Other financial masterminds package toxic derivatives for sale to unknowing pension funds, and rating agencies were paid to ensure the worthlessness of those packages still receive AAA ratings. Meanwhile, the banks were roughing up the homeowners. Bank of America foreclosed on tens of thousands of Americans by using unverified evidence called robo-signing. All they have for us is disdain, and that's why they didn't really earn it. Next up, How Wealth Reduces Compassion by Daisy Grewal from Common Dreams. This is short. Who is more likely to lie, cheat, and steal? The poor person or the rich one? It's tempting to think that the wealthier you are, the more likely you are to act fairly. After all, if you already have enough for yourself, it's easier to think about what others may need. But research suggests the opposite is true. As people climb the social ladder, their compassionate feelings towards others decline. Berkeley psychologists Paul Piff and Dacher Keltner ran several studies looking at whether social class, as measured by wealth, occupational prestige, and education, influences how much we care about the feelings of others. In one study, his colleagues discreetly observed the behavior of drivers at a busy four-way intersection. They found that luxury car drivers were more likely to cut off other motorists instead of waiting for their turn at the intersection. This was true both of men and women, upper-class drivers, regardless of the time of day or the amount of traffic at the intersection. In a different study, they found that luxury car drivers were also more likely to speed past a pedestrian and try to use a crosswalk, even after making eye contact with the pedestrian. In order to figure out whether selfishness leads to wealth rather than vice versa, a group of their colleagues ran a study where they manipulated people's class feelings. The researchers asked participants to spend a few minutes comparing themselves either to people better off or worse off than themselves financially. Afterwards, participants were shown a jar of candy and told that they could take home as much as they wanted. They were also told that the leftover candy would be given to children in a nearby laboratory. Those participants who had spent time thinking about how much better off they were compared to others ended up taking almost all the candy for themselves, leaving nothing for the children. A related set of studies published last year looked at how social class influences feelings of compassion towards people who are suffering. In one study, they found that less affluent individuals are more likely to report feeling compassion towards others on a regular basis. For example, they were more likely to agree with statements like, I often notice people who need help, and it's important to take care of people who are vulnerable. This was true even after controlling for other factors that we know affect compassion feelings, such as gender, ethnicity, and spiritual beliefs. And then they went on with other studies, and study after study after study came up with greed is good. And the more powerful you are, the more likely you are to be lacking in compassion. I'm sure there are exceptions, but that's their studies. And two more here, and then we're going to take your calls. From Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, Washington, D.C. leads the world in lawlessness. I'll quote from Global Research. The U.S. government pretends to live under the rule of law, to respect human rights, and to provide freedom and democracy to citizens. Washington's pretense and the stark reality are diametrically opposed. U.S. government officials routinely criticize other governments for being undemocratic and for violating human rights, yet no other country except Israel sends bombs, missiles, and drones into sovereign countries to murder civilian populations. The torture prisons in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and the CIA sacred rendition sites are the contributions of the Bush-Obama regimes to human rights. Washington violates the human rights of its own citizens. Washington has suspended the civil liberties guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution and declared its intention to detain U.S. citizens indefinitely without due process of law. President Obama has announced that he, at his discretion, can murder U.S. citizens, anyone who he wishes, without regard, as long as he perceives them as a threat to the U.S. Congress did not respond to these extraordinary announcements with impeachment proceedings. There was no uproar from the federal courts. Law schools or bar associations stayed quiet. Glenn Greenwald reports that the Department of Homeland Security harasses journalists who refuse to be prostitutes. And we have seen videos of the brutal police opposition to peaceful Occupy Wall Street protesters. Chris Floyd describes the torture perverts who rule the U.S. Now Washington is forcing as much of the world as it can to overthrow international treaties and international law. Washington has issued its own form of international law. Any country except those who receive Washington's dispensation that engages in trade with Iran or purchase Iran's oil will be sanctioned by the U.S. These countries will be cut off from U.S. markets, and their banking systems will not be able to use banks to process international payments. In other words, Washington's sanctions against Iran apply not to Iran, but to the countries that defy Washington to meet their energy needs with Iranian oil. According to the Christian Science Monitor, so far Washington has granted special privileges to Japan and 10 other European countries to continue purchasing Iranian oil, requiring countries to shut down their economies in order to comply with Washington's vendetta against Iran, a vendetta that has been ongoing ever since the Iranians overthrew the Washington-installed puppet, the Shah of Iran. Washington has permitted Japan to keep importing 85% of its normal oil from Iran. Washington's dispensations, however, are arbitrary. Dispensations have not been granted to China, India, Turkey, or South Korea. And why? Why? Well, India and China are the largest importers of Iranian oil, and Turkey and South Korea are among the top 10 importers. Before looking at possible unintended consequences of Washington's vendetta against Iran, what is Washington's case against Iran? Frankly, Washington has no case. It's a hoax of weapons of mass destruction all over again. Iran, unlike Israel, signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. All countries that signed the treaty have the right to nuclear energy. Washington claims that Iran is violating the treaty by developing a nuclear weapon. There's no evidence whatsoever of Washington's assertion. Washington's own 16 intelligence agencies are unanimous that Iran has no nuclear weapon program since 2003. Moreover, the International Atomic Energy Agency's weapons inspectors are in Iran all the time and have reported consistently that there are no diversions of nuclear material for the energy program to a weapons program. on the rare occasion when Washington is reminded of the facts, Washington makes a different case. Washington asserts that Iran's rights under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, notwithstanding, Iran cannot have a nuclear energy program because Iran would then have learned enough to be able to, at some future time, to make a bomb. The world has unilaterally decided the possibility that Iran might one day decide to make a nuke is too great a risk to take. It is better, Washington says, to drive up the oil price, disrupt the world economy, violate international law, and risk a major war than to have to worry about a future Iranian government will make a nuclear weapon. This is the Jeremy Bentham tyrannical approach to law that was repudiated by the Anglo-American legal system. It's difficult to characterize Washington's position as one of good judgment. Moreover, Washington has never explained the huge risk Washington sees in the possibility of an Iranian nuke. Why is this risk so much greater than, let's say, the risk associated with Soviet nukes or the nukes of the U.S., Russia, China, Israel, Pakistan, India, and North Korea today? Iran is a relatively small country. It does not have the Washington's world power ambitions. Unlike Washington, Iran is not at war with a half dozen other countries. In fact, it's at war with no one. Why is Washington destroying America's reputation as a country that respects law and risking a major war and economic dislocation over some possible future development, the probability of which is unknown? There is no good answer to this question. Lacking evidence for a case against Iran, Washington and Israel have substituted demonization. The lie has been established as truth that the current president of Iran intends to wipe out Israel off the face of the earth. This lie has succeeded in its propaganda, even though numerous language experts have proven that the intention attributed to the Iranian president by American-Israeli propaganda is a gross mistranslation of what he originally said. Once again, for Washington and its prostitutes, facts do not count. The agenda is all that counts, and any lie will be used to advance the agenda. Washington's sanctions could end up biting Washington harder than they bite Iran. What will Washington do if India, China, Turkey, and South Korea do not succumb to Washington's threats? According to recent news reports, India and China are not inclined to inconvenience themselves and to harm their economic development in order to support Washington's vendetta against Iran. Having watched China's rapid rise and have observed South Korea substantially, and then look at Turkey, where the civilian and somewhat Islamic government has managed to become independent of the U.S.-controlled Turkish military, appears to be slowly coming to the realization that Washington and NATO have Turkey in a service role in which Turkey is Washington's agent against its own kind. The Turkish government appears to be reassessing the benefits of being Washington's pawn. The success of the American-Israeli assault on Iran's independence depends upon India and China. If India and China give the bird to Washington, what can Washington do? Absolutely nothing. What if Washington, drowning in its own gigantic hubris, announces sanctions against India and China? Walmart shelves would be empty, and America's largest retailer would be hammering on the White House door. Apple Computer and innumerable powerful U.S. corporations, which have offshored their production for the America market to China, would see their profits evaporate. Together with their Wall Street allies, these powerful corporations would assault the fool in the White House with more force than the Red Army. The Chinese trade surplus would cease to flow into U.S. Treasury debt. The offshore to India back office operations of banks, credit card companies, and customer service departments of utilities throughout the United States would cease to function. In America, chaos would reign. Such are the rewards to the empire of the globalism that the empire has fostered. That's his thoughts, and I would add one thing. When you see the President of the United States hopscotching around the South Pacific and explaining how we're going to strengthen our national security and world security by putting more bases around China, what message do you think this sends to China? On the one hand, we buy their cheap products because they used to be made in the United States, but we outsource those, closing 50,000 factories in 10 years and losing over 8 million jobs. But in order to create and sustain our wars, we had to borrow money. And who is our number one loaner? China. How much are they holding? A minimum of $1 trillion. What would happen if the Chinese decided enough was enough. All they would have to do is start unloading our dollars on the world market. And overnight, our dollar would fall like a lead balloon. It would destroy our economy. Wall Street would drop 5,000 or 6,000 points. You think that maybe we have some really stupid and irresponsible people on the left and the right who just don't look far enough into a problem to see the consequences, intended or unintended, if you screw with the wrong people? Think about that, because China is the one country that we keep smacking and not realizing the power they have to smack back. And finally, four creepy ways Big Pharma peddles its drugs. And this is from my guest yesterday, Martha Rosenberg from Alternet. And this is from her book. Here's what she says. It's no secret that advertising works. Big Pharma wouldn't spend $4 billion a year on direct-to-consumer advertising if it didn't mean massive profits. What is more unknown is why drug ads that sow hypochondria, raise health fears, and sell diseases are often the most common and effective, even when the drugs themselves are of questionable safety. The nation's fourth most frequent drug ads were for a drug made by Eli Lilly, $3.1 billion in 1 year. It's an antidepressant, but it's linked to liver problems and suicide. Pfizer spent $157 million advertising its drug for fibromyalgia, Lyrica, and despite the seizures linked to life-threatening allergic reactions. The same year, it spent $107 million advertising an antidepressant, Prisquick, even though it also had links to liver problems. So how does pharma dupe us into using unsafe drugs? Today's drug ads targeted directly to consumers since 1999 seem to like they sell diseases and often cast women, children, the elderly, and mentally ill in a bad light. But a quick look at the ads before direct-to-consumer advertising in medical journals shows that drug ads have always done so. It's just the patients didn't used to see them. Here are some pharma's most offensive ad campaigns, then and now. Number one, you're sicker than you think. When psychiatric drugs first became popular for use in the general population in the 1960s, everyday personality problems became imbued with psychiatric labels. Quote, lady, your anxiety is showing. Mm-hmm. And then another ad, an older, wrinkly woman in a bouffant wig with gigantic sunglasses and garish jewelry. Quote, on the visible level, this middle-aged patient dresses to look young, exhibits a tense, continuous smile, may have bitten nails or overplucked eyebrows. What doesn't show as clearly as the coexisting depression she has, end quote. Well, the ads, both sexist and ageist, suggest the woman needs the antidepressant and tranquilizer, Trivel. Another ad from 1968 shows a bored upper-middle-class couple who, in reality, are supposed to be depressed. Quote, do you have patients who try to hide frustration behind conformity? Well, you'd think with such demeaning ads that people would be offended, but not the case. Psychiatric drugs are not just advertised for everyday personality problems. Pharma is pushing them for everyday pain conditions. Eli Lilly's original depression campaign for its drugs, quote, depression hurts, seems to anticipate its subsequent approval for pain conditions, including back pains. And they're spending heavy money on it. Then secondly, it's your kids are sick. Oh, look at how many American kids, 10 million, are on psychiatric drugs because they want to make your kids seem as if every single behavior your kid exhibits, something's wrong with that behavior and you better get them diagnosed and better get them on meds. Third is, be like me and you can be better. So they're trying to make us believe that we want to be like everyone else. All we have to do is take the drug to be like everyone else. And finally, one kind of ad you won't see anywhere anymore. Animal research at drug companies and the National Institutes of Health is a great scientific iceberg of which people only see a tip. In drug development, millions of animals die to prove a drug's so-called safety. At academic and medical centers, animal study grants from the National Institutes of Health provides millions to research these stupid things. So we don't see those ads anymore, but they like to make us believe that they have the research behind them. They do not. Those are some of the things that concern me that we don't hear about. Your thoughts. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment, and let me just mention again that we're going to be making, we have already sent out, I think, 700 copies of American Veterans documentary to vet groups to show it to their members so that we can also begin to do something positive for the vets. Back in a moment. Everyone, I'm Gary Nall. I'll be taking some calls from you in just here in a moment. And this is the latest. Yesterday they announced the Pulitzer Prize. This is from the Board's report, and here it is. Fox News wins the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. Quote, in an unprecedented honor for the Rupert Murdoch-led network, the Fox News Channel today won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. In its statement, the prize committee praises Fox for exhibiting, quote, an imagination and inventiveness that rival the best Charles Dickens and J.R. Tolkien. In hailing Fox, the committee singled out the network's 14-part story about President Obama's birth in a mud hut in Kenya. For Mr. Murdoch, the stunning Pulitzer Prize win has a rare bright spot in what he acknowledges has been a difficult year. When I first heard about the Pulitzer Prize Committee decision, I couldn't believe it. I had to listen to the voicemails to hear it for myself. Mm-hmm. Good. Well, everything else on there is fiction. Let's say hello to Al from New York. Al, your turn.
Hi, Gary. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good.
I just heard everything you had to say about Iran, the U.S., Israel, China, and I'm going to try to word this as best as possible because the whole situation seems so dumb. Like, I was wondering, with a person of your stature and your insight into this, what could possibly be the intentions for the U.S. to go into Iran and start this big mess, knowing that we already borrow from China just to support our wars alone?
I don't believe it has anything to do directly with the United States. I believe it has to do everything with Israel and the very tiny minority within the Likud party of Netanyahu, who've had this very pro-war, hawkish position for a long period of time. But then again, that's just extending their whole idea of the expanding settlements and not honoring any authentic way of appreciating what it means to be Palestinian. And the United States, remember, Iran's the second largest oil producer in the world behind Saudi Arabia. Third is Iraq, and fourth is Russia, though some claim Russia is actually second. So imagine that if you felt that, okay, if you had Iranian oil, which we had access to through the Shah of Iran, and brutalized the people and disappeared them, murdered them for almost 25 years under the Shah of Iran, which was under our direction. Now we could do that again. Then we would have both Iraq and Iran in our sights. It's foolish. It's a group of people that aren't a part of the real world who sit around in these think tanks and the neocons and figure out ways to make battles on paper and computer simulation models, but they've never been in the real world. So they're just stupid. Thanks for your call. For those of you who are listening, in about 4 minutes, we'll be ending our regular show over the hard lines. But anyone who wants to continue listening can by going to the telephone. We now have a telephone service anywhere in North America. You can call and listen to this show. It's 832-280-0066. 832-280-0066. And already, I think it's 400 companies using it. We're number one in the world, and we're estimating that this year, over the next 12 months, we'll have somewhere around 7 million minutes of people listening in. So it's a major vehicle for people. Let's say hello to Lou Ann Panessis, who's in studio. Hi, Lou Ann.
Hi, Gary. I just wanted to make a quick mention to you. I know you're on the road. We haven't had much contact with you, but we are full up for the sleepaway in June, and I am accepting people's calls if they want to be on a waiting list, because sometimes people do, you know, something comes up, they have to cancel. So if people are interested and they want to be on the waiting list, please give me a call. My number is 631-504-6198. That's 631-504-6198. And I have a question for you.
Yeah, by the way, I got to say sorry to the people on KPFK because I wasn't aware of that. And I'm out on the road and I'm not in touch and I don't have my computer. So I asked people to call you. So sorry if they called and they couldn't get through or that were filled up. What's your question?
The question is this. People listen to you on the air every day, and they see how busy you are. You're making documentaries. You're helping people. You're filming. You're on the radio. And yet you take 2 weeks out of your life to be with a small group of people. And I just don't, personally, from where I'm sitting, I'm wondering, why would you take 2 weeks out of your busy schedule? What do you hope to achieve with these people? I mean, I've been interviewing them. They're a really nice group of people that are very eager to be a part of this whole experience. But I'm asking you, what do you hope to achieve from working with these people?
The same reason that this Sunday and at 90th Street and 5th Avenue in Central Park, there'll be anywhere from 50 to 100 individuals who'll be meeting there. And John Q and all of our the Ortegas and others will be there coaching people not to race the marathon, but rather just to get into shape, to get their body moving, to see how to do it right. The reward is when a human being that you didn't know, weren't connected to, changes their life and transcends the limitations of the irrelevance of where they were at to something that's highly relevant today, in effect, a new beginning. Too often in our lives, we believe that the only chapter that we have is the chapter we're in. And how long have we lived with bad intentions or negative or depressed or frustrated situations and circumstances instead of simply calling it a stop? Just stop. Let me go forward into a new day. And I believe we all deserve a new day. It's up to the person to decide, is this the day for them to become new? And if they are, then I'm one of those individuals. There are many of us out there who are guides. All we do is act like catalysts, provide people with some insights of what are possible with diet or with exercise or with stress management. So if you want to be different, if you want to live different, then you have to think different. And the hard part is the thinking different. The easy part's the diet. The easy part's the supplements. The easy part's are the what you do to really feed the body. It's adjusting the mind after decades of conditioning that's the hard part. And it's one thing to do it over the radio. It's another thing when you're working with people on a Sunday in the park and you've got a couple hours to work with them and you're able to talk about the issues that are important. You ask people, how much time do we spend in the park at 95th Avenue talking about life issues versus running? Most of the time, it's life issues. Then we run. And if we didn't talk about the life issues, there's a high probability the person wouldn't come back the next week because by Tuesday, their legs are going to be a little tight. They're going to be sore. They might have a blister. They're going to think, gee whiz, that was kind of rough. I don't know if I want to do that. But if you help a person, encourage them to change their behavior by changing their attitude, by changing their beliefs, then they look forward to coming back. The pain of what you haven't used now starting to feel energized, that is where you have to make your motivation. Keeping people on a healthy diet is easy if they have first had an adjustment in their attitude and changed their perception. You know, yesterday you mentioned about a woman who came to see me a long time ago when I was lecturing in Phoenix I think it was Phoenix, and at the very beginning of my career, and there were thousands, I think she said 7,000 or 8,000 people in the audience. It was a humongous crowd, and it was just myself for an evening with him, and I spent about 4 hours with him. And I met, for the first time, Dr. Pavel Airola and Dr. Walker. And afterwards, we had some long conversations because we went over to Pavel Airola's place to have a late dinner. And both of them were just wonderful human beings, very real people. And one of the things that Dr. Walker said, he says, Gary, you're aware that there's no one young under 60 in the entire health field. And here you're in your early 20s. He said, there's this enormous gap. And he said, so my suggestion is this. Spend the next couple of years spending as much time as you can with Paul Bragg and Linda Clark and the others who have been around a while. Because these are the ethical people. These are the people that you'll learn a lot from. Unfortunately, I was not able to do that. And yet he was right. As far as I knew, they were all very ethical people. He said, because you want their knowledge. Because these are people who are alive and famous in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. They've had their day. This day is over. But we're still relevant because of our knowledge. And boy, did that stick in my mind. We're relevant because of our knowledge. Knowledge never becomes irrelevant. Hence, you never become irrelevant if you are aligned with something that is in it itself larger than your own life, like doing good for others, helping the poor, helping those in need. That's highly relevant. That ties into one of the things that I was talking about with someone who's now going through a depression because all the time, energy, effort he's given for years to the non-commercial radio station has been for naught. And he said, my whole life is just irrelevant. I'm in this deep, funky place. And I said, remember what George Bernard said, the worst sin towards our fellow creatures is not to hate them, but to be indifferent to them. That's the essence of inhumanity. When you're indifferent to someone, you exclude them from relevance. You've heard me say that in America today, we only have one truth, one relevance, and that is official relevance and official truth. You're an official celebrity or you don't exist. You're an official basketball star, you don't exist. You're an official news person. When I was on ABC Network and I had the number one rated show for 12 years, it was relevant. Invited to hundreds, thousands of lectures, doctors, seminars everywhere. When I was on MCA, WMC, same thing. BAI, not. Why? Any less quality of material? No, because BAI is not official. Then again, look at Chris Hedges. Wins the Pulitzer Prize in the New York Times, arguably our finest, most articulate, insightful, an impassioned orator out there today on social issues, yet he's not quoted anywhere except in some of the alternative media because he's no longer officially accepted. The holistic doctor that heals the patients, that has the insights, is no longer considered official and excluded by using terms such as holistic, and that immediately excludes you from any credibility or relevance. You no longer are relevant. Hence, you can be looked upon with indifference. Education, religion, ethics, law, health, medicine, every single area, as long as you stay official, you stay relevant. When you're no longer official, you're irrelevant. And hence we put enormous amounts of credibility into people who are misguiding us, who are sociopathical, who do not have decency or ethics, and yet we give them credibility, where the people who do have credibility and ethics, we ignore. We become indifferent. That is what George Bernard Shaw was saying is the sin of fellow creatures. So now we have the truth, and the truth is that what we've been living at is that the truth has only been an official truth. So to regain our sense of relevance, reconnect with what is relevant to helping people. And then you find relevance in your own life. I told my friend, I said, look, why don't you align with some of the groups that are doing good work, where you know that your work and your efforts will be appreciated and something good will come from it. But he's into redemption. Do you know how many times, Luann, people would rather redeem a flawed relationship, redeem something they've done, said that is wrong, rather than going forward, surrendering the past, letting the past be, and becoming relevant again with the day you live in. That's all the time we have. I want to thank you all for listening. Have a nice day, everyone.